potentially engaged in criminal conduct, egregious enough to warrant a referral to the U.S. Justice Department. The sources said House investigators are interested in whether Donald Trump oversaw a criminal conspiracy after communications turned over by Trump's former chief of staff Mark Meadows and others suggested the White House coordinated effort to stop Joe Biden's certification. The source said the select committee has several thousand messages, among which include some that suggest the Trump White House briefed a number of House Republicans on its plan for then-Vice President Mike Pence to abuse his ceremonial role and not certify Joe Biden's election win. The sources said the fact that the Select Committee has messages suggesting the Trump White House directed Republican members of Congress to execute a scheme to stop Joe Biden's certification is significant, as it could give rise to the panel considering referrals for potential crimes. The sources noted members and counsel on the Select Committee are examining in the first instance whether in seeking to stop the certification, Donald Trump and his aides violated the federal law that prohibits obstruction of a congressional proceeding. The joint session on 6th of January. The sources said the Select Committee believes that Donald Trump may be culpable of an obstruction charge, given he failed for hours to intervene to stop the violence on the Capitol perpetrated by his supporters in his name. But the sources added the Select Committee is also looking at whether Donald Trump oversaw an unlawful conspiracy that involved coordination between the political elements of the White House plan, communicated to Republican lawmakers, and extremist groups that stormed the Capitol. That would probably be the most serious charge for which the Select Committee might consider a referral, as it considers a range of other criminal conduct that has emerged in recent weeks, from obstruction of justice to potential wire fraud by the GOP. The vice chair of the Select Committee, the Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, referenced the obstruction charge when she read from the criminal code before members voted unanimously last November to recommend Mark Meadows in contempt of Congress for refusing to testify. The Guardian previously reported that Donald Trump personally directed lawyers and political operatives working from the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. to find ways to stop Joe Biden's certification from happening at all on 6th of January, just hours before the Capitol attack. But the sources said House investigators are yet to find evidence tying Donald Trump personally to the Capitol attack and may ultimately only recommend referrals for the straight obstruction charge, which has already been brought against around 275 rioters rather than for conspiracy. The U.S. Justice Department could yet charge Donald Trump and aides separate to the Select Committee investigation, but one of the sources said the panel, as of mid-December, had no idea whether the agency is actively examining potential criminality by the former president. A spokesperson for the House Select Committee declined to comment on details about the investigation. A spokesperson for the U.S. Justice Department declined to comment whether the agency had opened a criminal inquiry for Donald Trump and his closest allies over 6th of January. The sources said still the Select Committee appears to be moving towards making at least some referrals, or alternatively recommendations in its final report that an aggressive prosecutor at the U.S. Justice Department could use to pursue a criminal inquiry. The Select Committee is examining the evidence principally to identify legislative reforms to prevent a repeat of Donald Trump's plan to subvert the election. The members say if they find Donald Trump violated federal laws, they have an obligation to refer that to the U.S. Justice Department. sending a criminal referral to the U.S. Justice Department, especially a recommendation for prosecution, carries no formal legal weight, since Congress lacks the authority to force it to open a case, and House investigators have no authority to charge witnesses with a crime. But a credible criminal referral from the Select Committee could have a substantial political effect, given the importance of the 6th of January inquiry, and place pressure on the Attorney General Merrick Garland to initiate an investigation or explain why he might not do so. The sources said internal discussions about criminal referrals intensified after communications turned over by Mark Meadows revealed alarming lines of communication between the Trump White House and Republican lawmakers over 6th of January. In one exchange released by the Select Committee, one Republican lawmaker texted Mark Meadows an apology for not pulling off what might have amounted to a coup, saying 6th of January was a terrible day, not because of the attack, but because they were unable to stop Joe Biden's certification. The sources said the Select Committee believes messages such as that text, as well as remarks from a Republican on the House floor as the Capitol came under attack, might represent one part of a conspiracy by the White House to obstruct the joint session of the Congress. In referencing objections to six states, the text also appears to comport with a memo authored by the Trump lawyer John Eastman that suggested lodging objections to six states, raising the specter the White House distributed the plan more widely than previously known. Benny Thompson, the chairman of the Select Committee, added on ABC News recently that the investigation had found evidence to suggest the events of 6th of January appeared to be coordinated effort on the part of a number of people to undermine the election. Counsel for the Select Committee indicated in their contempt of Congress report for Mark Meadows that they intended to ask Donald Trump's former chief of staff about those communications he turned over voluntarily before he broke off a cooperation deal and refused to testify. One of the sources said Benny Thompson has also suggested to reporters that he believes Mark Meadows stopped cooperating with the inquiry in part because of pressure from Donald Trump. But the Select Committee has not opened a separate witness intimidation investigation into the former president.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and especially the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we will look at the recent civilian killings in the northeastern Indian state of Nagaland and why calls are growing louder for the repeal of a controversial law. And we shall discuss the breach of religious freedom in Indian-controlled Kashmir, vis-à-vis the closure of the region's central mosque and a ban on Muharram processions.
The recent civilian killings in India's Nagaland state have reignited the long-running debate over a controversial law that confers armed forces with unbridled powers, prompting the Provincial Legislative Assembly to unanimously pass a resolution calling for its abrogation. The trigger was the killing of six coal mine workers early this month in a botched counter-insurgency operation. In the ensuing clashes, seven more civilians were killed. The incidents sparked widespread protests in Nagaland and fueled calls for the repeal of the law.
On the fateful evening of December the 4th, Indian Army soldiers opened fire at a pickup truck carrying coal miners in Nagaland's Mon district. 6 civilians were killed on the spot. Later that day, 7 more civilians and a soldier died in clashes between people and police. On December the 5th, 1 more civilian was shot dead when angry protesters ambushed an army camp. Army soldiers had apparently mistaken the group of coal miners for insurgents. India's Home Minister Amit Shah said the government regretted what he called the unfortunate incident, describing civilian killings as the case of mistaken identity. In the days after Shah's statement, angry protesters filled the streets across Nagaland and adjoining states, demanding the minister's apology and, more importantly, calling for the repeal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act, a draconian law that provides grounds for men in uniform in India's so-called disturbed areas to commit horrendous human rights abuses. On December the 20th, the Nagaland State Assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding that the BJP government at centre repeal the controversial and much-abused law from the state and from the rest of the northeast. It also demanded that the appropriate authority issue an apology for the massacre and that justice be delivered to the perpetrators.
It's not the first instance that the Armed Forces Special Powers Act has hogged headlines for the wrong reasons. The controversial law, enacted in 1958 to maintain control and curb insurgency in what the Indian government considered disturbed areas, is in force in at least 5 Indian states. The legislation has drawn flak from national and international human rights watchdogs as it gives unbridled powers and immunity to the armed personnel to shoot, kill, make arrests on flimsy pretexts, conduct searches without warrant, and demolish structures.
The controversial law, also known as AFSPA, was first enacted in 1958 to allow deployment of armed forces to counter a secessionist movement in the hills of Nagaland. 6 decades later, it is in force in Manipur, Assam, parts of Arunachal Pradesh, and in the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir, the places labelled as disturbed areas. The legislation gives license to Indian Army soldiers to carry out excesses without fear of legal prosecution, even when they kill and injure people, raid houses without warrant, or use deadly and indiscriminate force on mere suspicion, like the case of Nagaland killings. The law has long shielded Indian soldiers stationed in the so-called disturbed areas from accountability for grave human rights abuses and has denied justice to the affected families. A 2019 report on Jammu and Kashmir by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the law remains a key obstacle to accountability. Following the latest incident in Nagaland, which has shaken the conscience of the nation of 1.3 billion people, calls for repealing the law have grown louder in all northeastern states. But will the BJP government in New Delhi move to abolish it? No one is quite ready to bet on that.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Kalol Bhattacharjee, Senior Assistant Editor with the Hindu newspaper. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. Let's begin with the recent civilian killings in northeast India's Nagaland state, which have reignited the long-running debate about the use and abuse of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. Now, can you tell us what exactly happened in Nagaland?
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me to this bulletin and this discussion on the developments regarding AFSPA or AFSPA, as we call it in India. What happened that evening in Nagaland is that a group of daily wage workers were returning home from their work in a nearby mine. And while they were returning, they were ambushed by a group of Indian soldiers who also were reportedly working on solid intelligence inputs that a group of insurgents were waiting to carry out an attack on the Indian soldiers. So the report that came later on to us is that these soldiers were targeted by these reported insurgents, and therefore this ambush was carried out in a defensive way, so that those insurgents could be neutralized. However, later on we heard that the issue was of mistaken identity, as it was claimed by the Indian Home Minister in the Parliament, and that the soldiers felt that they were going to be ambushed by a group of insurgents, and therefore they acted in self-defense. But very soon we got to know that the local villagers were the first to arrive at the scene, and they discovered that the bodies of those people who had been shot dead were being loaded onto a jeep or some other vehicles that the army soldiers were driving around in. So the local villagers came, and then they attacked the Indian soldiers, and which really led to a massive mayhem at that point. And that was the main reason that an Indian soldier also lost his life. It was, in brief, the entire sequence of events.
So, Mr. Bhattacharjee, this much abused law grants the Indian Army unbridled powers to maintain public order in so-called disturbed areas. Now, do you think this is a smokescreen to escape accountability for human rights abuses?
I would also like to mention that this particular area of Nagaland is very close to the international border with Myanmar. And also please remember that the crisis in Myanmar has been escalating over the last 8 months or so. And the international community has not really acted in a collective manner to ensure any sort of pressure on the Myanmarese junta. What's happening as a result is that there is a spillover effect on the nearby areas, especially on India's northeastern areas, where a lot of the smuggling activities have heightened, because the Myanmar the rulers themselves are involved in drugs and other sorts of smuggling activities. And what's of great concern is that apart from the exodus of people from Myanmar, there is also this influx of these goods and items and drugs into India's border areas and also into Bangladesh. So this has also heightened tension among the heightened tension as well as distrust among the armed forces or the law enforcement agencies, as well as the locals and those people who are involved in those sort of activities, illicit activities. So this basically, in the context of this particular development in India's neighboring Myanmar, what's happening is that this kind of a law, that is a law like AFSPA, has more chances of getting abused, because if there is faulty information or intelligence about a certain movement of drugs or movement of insurgents, then this sort of laws actually increase the chances of such incidents being repeated in future as well.
Like you've mentioned, there have been numerous protests in northeastern Indian states as well as in Jammu and Kashmir against this law over the years. Now, how do Indian authorities justify its continued use?
Well, as you understand, the situation in Kashmir has been problematic for a very long time because of India's position as well as because of Pakistan's perceived interference. What happens in Kashmir is that the law and order situation on the ground is always very fragile because of cross-border attempts from the Pakistani side to keep the pot boiling in Kashmir. And on the ground level, you have a big presence of the ultras or the other insurgents from the other side are always present in some numbers. So that is one issue which the Indian state has often cited as one of the main reasons why it has kept AFSPA in Kashmir. And that is often the only answer that we have received from the Indian state or whenever the extra-legal developments have taken place in Kashmir. Having said that, I must say that that is not the only legal instrument in the hands of the Indian state as far as Kashmir is concerned, because the region is highly militarized. And in that context, not a very normal governance process can't really function. And therefore, the Kashmiri situation is very unique. And the Indian state has often cited that as one of the main reasons that has enabled its use of AFSPA on the ground in Kashmir.
Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Why has there been no international outcry over the Indian government's use of the controversial law?
Well, there has not been any international outcry on the AFSPA, primarily because India prides itself on its democratic credentials. But also please remember that after this particular incident took place in Nagaland, whether we call it an outcry or not, the issue of AFSPA or the abuse of such extra-legal matters laws by the enforcement agencies or the Indian Armed Forces has been taken up by the UN Human Rights Council.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Senior Indian journalist Supriya Sharma says the families of civilians killed by the Indian Army in Nagaland have refused government compensation until the culprits are punished and the controversial law is repealed. Conrad Sangma, the Chief Minister of Northeastern Indian State of Meghalaya, extends his support to protesters in Nagaland in their demand to have AFSPA repealed from the Northeast. A legislator from northwestern Gujarat state, Jignesh Mavani, says the Nagaland killings should force authorities to rethink and review the draconian law so that accountability can be fixed.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The centuries-old central mosque in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir has remained largely locked for the past 2 years since the abrogation of the region's special status sparked unrest. Built in the 15th century, the mosque is seen by Indian authorities as a trouble spot. It's a place where Kashmiri Muslims gather to offer Friday prayers and to raise voice for their legitimate political aspirations. They see its closure as denial of their right to religious freedom.
The closure of the Himalayan region's 600-year-old central mosque known as Jamia Masjid and denial of permission to Kashmiri Muslims to hold the congressional Friday prayers for the past 2 years has deepened anger and resentment among them. The mosque was shut down immediately after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi stripped Indian-controlled Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status. In the past 2 years, which have been marked by intermittent protests and shutdowns, the historic mosque has remained out of bounds to worshippers on Fridays, even though authorities allow it to remain open on other days. Jamia Masjid has played a key role in the region's turbulent history. It has traditionally been the bastion of resistance against Kashmir's autocratic rulers. In 1819, Sikh rulers had closed it for 21 years. During the rule of Dogra Hindu dynasty between 1846 and 1947, the mosque often remained shut. In the past 30 years, since the anti-India resistance gained momentum in Kashmir, Jamia Masjid has been subject to periodic bans and lockdowns by successive Indian governments. The chief priest of the mosque and senior pro-freedom leader, Mirwaz Umar Farooq, has often delivered fiery political speeches from the mosque's pulpit, highlighting the political struggle of Kashmiris. Interestingly, in the year 1980, during his visit to Kashmir, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had also delivered a historic sermon at the mosque, which focused on Shia-Sunni unity.
While the Indian government, as part of sweeping measures to crush political dissent, has imposed a tougher security clampdown in Indian-controlled Kashmir since October 2019, infringement of religious freedom has been a long-lasting phenomenon in the disputed region. Besides closing mosques and putting religious leaders and clerics under house arrest, there is a long-running ban on the historic Muharram 10 procession in Srinagar city, which Kashmiri Muslims see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom.
Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to the early 16th century when both Shia and Sunni Muslims would come together to parade the streets on the day of Ashura. The processions were banned during the rule of Afghans, followed by Mughals, Sikhs and Dogras, who had a hostile attitude towards Shias. However, in the latter part of the Dogra rule in the late 19th century, the tradition was revived with the cooperation of both the communities. In 1989, when armed resistance against the Indian rule began in Kashmir, the government of India moved swiftly to impose a ban on the procession as part of sweeping measures to deal with the political unrest. Almost 33 years later, the ban remains in place. Each year, police impose curfew-like restrictions on Muharram 8th and 10th in the heart of Srinagar city to foil the Muharram processions. And each year, thousands of mourners defy the ban and carry out peaceful processions while being subjected to brutal police action. Mourners are intercepted by heavily armed police and paramilitary personnel who fire tear smoke canisters and resort to baton charge. Last year, dozens of them were arrested who spent months in jail. Despite repeated pleas, the successive Indian governments have refused to lift the illegal ban.
Now, to have more insight, I would like to welcome Mr. Zamir Ahmed Awan to the program. He is an ex-diplomat and political analyst. Mr. Awan, the centuries-old Grand Mosque of Kashmir has remained closed for the past 2 years. Why is the historic mosque seen as a trouble spot by Indian authorities?
Thank you very much for inviting me to give my comments. In fact, it is a symbolic mosque. It belongs to the Islamic history and represent the Muslim community in the Kashmir. Historically, India was ruled by the Muslim for almost 800 years, and there was a complete harmony between the Muslims and the other religions in India under the Islamic rule. Since the India got independence in 1947, for almost seven decades, Muslims and other minorities in India were living almost peacefully. But since the BJP government took power under the leadership of Narendra Modi, the extremist wings like RSS are promoting hate against the minorities, especially against the Muslims. And they have an agenda to purify the India as a pure Indian state without any other religion. So they are also harming other religion in addition to the Muslim, like Christian, Sikhs and Buddhists and all other religion. Especially in the Kashmir, where the Muslims are in the majority, they are more harming the Muslims. And this mosque has historical importance. That's why they have closed for the almost couple of years.
Mr. Awan, the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi has taken many controversial measures since October 2019. Now, do you see the closure of the mosque as part of a plan to deny Kashmiris their religious freedom?
You are absolutely right. Since 2019, Narendra Modi, when won the election, his slogan was to convert the India into a pure Hindu state. And he has got the support from all the extremist Hindu groups like RSS. And as per his agenda, as per his promise in the election, he have to take severe and extremist measures against the minorities, not only against the Muslim but also against the Christian and other religions also. Amended Citizen Act, cancelling the constitution and occupying the occupied Kashmir, and also many other measures which are extremist, and that is the part of their political plan, and they might do something more harmful to the Muslims.
So for Muslims in Kashmir, the mosque closure also brings painful memories from the past. Why has this mosque always been at the center of political storm?
Always the center point for the political activities in Kashmir. The Muslim freedom movement in Kashmir is always having meetings there and gathering there, and a lot of protest against the Indian government was originated from this mosque. And in past also the Indian security forces has sealed it and closed it for many times, but recently they have taken various prolonged action to close down this mosque. I think it is political motivated and ill planned.
Mr. Awan, the Indian government has also not allowed the historic Muharram procession to take place in the Srinagar city for the past 3 decades. Now, why is it afraid of peaceful religious practices of Kashmiri Muslims?
In fact, the Indian government is suppressing the Muslims and not allowing them to perform their religious duties. The procession of Muharram is a ritual and has been performing for many centuries peacefully, but Indian government is afraid when the Muslims are gathered, they might protest against the government, or they might make some slogans against the government. So in preventing such situation, they have not allowed the Muharram procession for several years. In fact, not only the Muharram procession, but also other religious activities also are banned.
Mr. Awan, while Muslims are barred from exercising their right to religious freedom, Hindus are allowed to perform their religious rites, even publicly. Now, do these double standards point to something deeply sinister?
In India, there are many other religions and minorities. The dominating is the Brahman, which are only 8% of the whole population, but they are in power, they are in the government, they are in the bureaucracy, they are in the security forces, they are in the police, they are in the district management, and they are controlling all these things, and they are suppressing the Muslims, especially in the Kashmir, where Muslims are in the majority.
Mr. Awan, thank you for being on the program. Love to talk to you again. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Zubair Amin, a Kashmir-based independent journalist, notes that Kashmiri Muslims have long accused New Delhi of curbing their religious freedom on the pretext of law and order, while promoting and patronizing the annual Hindu pilgrimage. Multimedia journalist from Kashmir, Mukhtar Zahur, pictures a man who travelled 40 kilometres to offer Friday prayers at Kashmir's central mosque, only to realise that it has been shut. Masroor Ansari, a senior Kashmiri pro-freedom leader, slams the Kashmir police for brutal use of force to thwart a peaceful Muharram procession in Srinagar recently.
And that was our episode about the growing calls in India for the repeal of a controversial law in the wake of the recent civilian killings in Nagaland state and also the denial of religious freedom to Kashmiri Muslims by the Indian government. Take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The so-called war on terror has failed, but failure, they say, is a better teacher than success. And if the US can learn from this failure and how it was generated, it may be able to avoid more disasters in the future, says Anatole Levin, writer, in an article titled How the So-Called Global War on Terror Failed Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. In January 2002, at the start of the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, British historian and former soldier Sir Michael Howard published an essay in Foreign Affairs titled, What's in a Name? How to Fight Terrorism. In it, he warned that defining the U.S. response to 9/11 as the so-called War on Terror would shape U.S. policies in profoundly negative ways. As he wrote, to use, or rather to misuse, the term war is not simply a matter of legality or pedantic semantics. It has deeper and more dangerous consequences. To declare that one is at war is immediately to create a war psychosis that may be totally counterproductive for the objective being sought. Like others, Howard pinpointed the risk that declaring war on such a nebulous enemy as terror would make that war unending. That war would only drive populations into support for the terrorists and create a with us or against us attitude that would make it impossible to win over people from the other side. And that the longer wars continued, the greater these tendencies would become. He argued instead for the use of intelligence actions, diplomatic pressure, and limited force. The wisdom of Howard's words has been amply demonstrated by the disastrous outcomes of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, Howard's allocutions about the so-called War on Terror should also be placed in a wider context of U.S. foreign and security policy in the past and future. The creation of meta-narratives, all-encompassing frameworks of thought and analysis into which a wide range of quite different issues are fitted. These narratives are focused on one supposedly monolithic, universal, and overwhelmingly powerful enemy, which it is necessary to confront everywhere. They are fed by American exceptionalist nationalism with its conviction of America's duty to lead the world to the inevitable triumph of democracy. This enemy is cast not only as a military and ideological adversary, but a force of evil. The United States of America representing not only freedom and democracy, but good itself. This is how most Americans understood the Cold War. And amid the rain of condemnation that it is falling on President Joe Biden over Afghanistan, it is vital to remember that not just the disaster of Iraq, but that of Afghanistan too, had their origins in how the George W. Bush administration turned the pursuit of the small terrorist group actually responsible for 9/11 into a global struggle for freedom and against evil. The so-called War on Terror has failed, but failure, they say, is a better teacher than success. And if the U.S. can learn from this failure and how it was generated, it may be able to avoid more disasters in the future. For U.S. strategy towards China is also beginning to be portrayed in Washington as an apocalyptic global struggle between with consequences that may dwarf those of the so-called War on Terror. Every significant country in the world has its own variant of a foreign and security establishment, and these establishments operate in accordance with certain informal but strict doctrines. These are deeply rooted in geographical location, in specific nationalisms, and in the histories and cultures of the nations concerned. They are, to a considerable extent, impervious to evidence and argument, and barring defeat in war or revolutionary upheaval at home, they change only very slowly. The doctrine of the current U.S. establishment stands out in certain key respects. The first is the scale of its ambition. the belief that the U.S. must seek primacy across the entire face of the globe. The second is its ideological content, the belief that the U.S. has a mission to spread democracy and freedom in the world. American religious traditions in turn help to cast this mission as a crusade for good against evil. There is, however, one additional and paradoxical feature of U.S. foreign policy doctrine, that is, the profound and justified doubts of the U.S. establishment about how far it is really shared by the U.S. population at large. Living in what is in effect a giant island protected by the oceans and with friendly or weak states to north and south, U.S. citizens are subject to periodic doubts about whether outside forces are really so dangerous to them and therefore whether the expenditure of U.S. blood and treasure on defeating them is really justified. U.S. meta-narratives are therefore also heavily shaped with an eye to terrifying ordinary Americans. Economic divide.
He is one of the youngest presidents of a country. Gabriel Boric has been elected into office in Chile, promising an orderly economy. But what is that? Is he going to pull Chile's economy out of the one that has led it to be one of the most unequal countries in the world? Hi, I'm Kavit Halfway. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide, where we will look at Chile's economic future under its new president. Coming up, Chile's new president, his economic plans, promise to install a welfare state, to expand social rights, but to do so with fiscal responsibility. Will that help pull Chile out of its economic downturn? Also, we will take a look at Chile's inequality, one of the world's most unequal nations. But why, when it has an abundance of natural resources like copper, not to mention lithium? Also, we're going to take a look at a trend that is happening in Latin America. Boric is one of a handful of Latin American leaders who has come from the left. Why is Latin America seeing a rise of the left? Also, something that has been noticed in Peru. And the big one is possibly to come in Brazil.
It was an election that just months ago did not foresee the rise of a 35-year-old to the highest job in the country. But that is what happened. Gabriel Boric, a former student leader, won the presidential election in Chile with 55% of the vote. He describes himself as a moderate socialist who will seek to maintain fiscal discipline as he advances his reforms. Some of these reforms include raising taxes on the rich, raising taxes on the mining industry, rejecting projects that damage the environment, improving social services, dismantling the private pension system, which is why you have economists looking at Chile's economic future with pessimism.
When Chile's new president-elect won the elections, it looked like Wall Street was attacking him because of his liberal policies, economically speaking, with many headlines sounding off the alarm on his win. Like this one, President-elect Boric aims to undo Chile's economic progress. The Wall Street Journal said his wish list included ending private pensions. It would destroy Chile's capital markets. Now, this headline was a no-holds-barred display of using scare tactics. Aside from saying how Chile's stock market and currency have fallen, it went on to say that the new president would oppose some mining projects and will govern a divided Congress. There's about 5 negative points in this particular descriptions. And if that wasn't enough, the article goes on to describe Boric as the leader of a left-wing coalition, which included the Chilean Communist Party, further describing Boric as bearded and tattooed 35-year-old former student leader. But Boric's critics were in for a surprise. As of December 31st, Bloomberg reported that Chile's unemployment rate had fallen for the 8th straight month, reaching levels last seen before the pandemic. The jobless rate fell to 7.5% between September and November, and retail sales in November grew 16.7% lower than expected. Well, joining us for this segment is Carlos Patricio Gonzalez. Now, he's got a rather long resume here, which is noteworthy for us to highlight. He's a senior lecturer at London South Bank University in the UK. He's also a Chilean former political prisoner of Pinochet regime, exiled in Britain as a result. Expertise he has in urbanism, architecture and technology design at City Resilience. And currently he's doing research into homelessness in Chile with a sabbatical during 2022 to research the plight of people in homeless dwellers, emergency camps in Santiago and in Valparaiso. All right, well, welcome, a warm welcome to you, Carlos, and thanks for joining us here on Economic Divide. We're looking at Chile's new president-elect in terms of his, what he has called fiscal discipline. He wants to enact reforms that he has said, like raising taxes on the rich and also on the mining industry, rejecting projects that are not too climate-friendly when it comes to that. And also, we're looking at how he wants to dismantle the pension system. Are these promised reforms actually realistic? Do you think he'll be able to do them?
It will depend. It will depend on several factors. There are talks now by the forces that support Gabriel Boric with other center-left forces like the Socialists, the Christian Democrats, etc., who they were in government in the recent years, especially the government of Michel Bachelet in the past, in order to broaden the support for the changes. Now, especially when we are encountering a parliament recently elected that it's almost even, slight advantages for the left on the lower chamber, but equally divided in the higher chamber. So, there are even talks to right-wing moderate forces in the parliament in order to pass legislation, because many of the policies that Boric bring in to the front need be passed through parliament, especially tax reforms, the end of the pension system, new health services system, etc.
All right, very good. Let's see what Dennis Small thinks. Let me bring him in. Dennis Small is a Latin America editor at the Executive Intelligence Review. Dennis Small, welcome to Economic Divide. We're looking at the Chilean new president-elect and some of the promises that he has made, such as eliminating the pension system or rejecting projects, especially in the industrial sector, that are not climate-friendly, not to mention raising taxes on the rich. Do you think that he's going to actually be able to execute these promised reforms? Especially, obviously, ones that he ran during his presidential campaign.
Well, I think he will certainly attempt to lessen the divide, but again, Chile is a little bit of a microcosm of the whole world. Over the last 2 years of the pandemic and the 10 years since the last crisis, the inequality worldwide has grown phenomenally, where the vulgarly rich have become extremely vulgarly rich, and there is broader impoverishment, hunger, and disease around the world, with some countries facing potential starvation of the majority of their population, such as Afghanistan. That said, I think that Chile does have potential to move in the direction of lessening that divide. Chile is a young country on top of everything else. It's not only is the president young at 35, but the population that voted for him is generally quite young. And the party system, the existing institutional parties have been very badly defeated in this election, which means that people are looking for a new and different way out. I think a lot of Boric's success or not will depend on him providing a mission, a sense of national purpose, especially to the young in the country. And in this regard, one of the most promising areas, in my view, especially to the degree which the Belt and Road extends itself through South America, and Chile becomes part of that, with Argentina and Brazil after the elections and others.
Hello and welcome to our first InfoNews section of the year. And we are going to start off this section with a piece of news that shows the U.S. double standards in full display. Now, this piece of crypto news was an eye-opener. It said that the U.S. government has a huge secret crypto stockpile that it had been seizing and then auctioning off cryptocurrencies, and this was in a span of years. It had gained so much steam that it enlisted the help of the private sector to manage the storage and the sales of its hoard of tokens. So much for the U.S. being against crypto and Bitcoin in particular. Moving on to our next piece, it's the holiday season for Americans, but many are not in a festive mood, as evident from this headline. 21 million Americans don't have enough to eat this holiday season. This is especially true for the ones who are in the low-income category. Low-income families may soon face additional pressures as monthly child tax credit payments are ending. Not good news for, obviously, low-income Americans in the U.S. And staying with the U.S. for our next piece, this headline posed the question, what's driving higher prices? The answer, unchecked corporate power. But the real reason for inflation is the increasing concentration of the American economy into the hands of a few. And who are the few? They are the corporate giants with the power to raise prices. After all, they need to make up for the losses that were incurred during the pandemic. And our final piece, in the growing competition between the U.S. and China, China has unveiled new plans to spearhead robot revolution. Automation plans have come amid escalating tech rivalry with the United States. Now, its goal to digitize the operations of 70% of its domestic manufacturers by the year 2025.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
In this in-depth section, we will look at the rise of the left in Latin America, especially now that Chile's new president-elect, Gabriel Boric, has swept into power. But is there really a surge in leftist parties? Well, for starters, what is the meaning of left-wing in politics? Taking a look at the definition, the left refers to people and groups that actually have what's called liberal or revolutionary views. This can include communism or it could even include socialism. Meanwhile, the word right, in contrast, it refers to people or groups that have conservative views. It also can include extreme nationalistic viewpoints. Okay? All right. Now, in our case, our focus is the left. Is there a rise of the left in Latin America? That answer is a resounding yes. It began with the win of Manuel López Obrador, the Mexican president, back in 2018. Xiomara Castro, the Honduran president, which became the first female president, is another example. Moving on to Pedro Castillo, Peru's president, who saw a narrow win in the presidency there. And, of course, Gabriel Boric, the Chilean president-elect, which has come into power, a subject of this program. And now there are speculations on this man, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, to become Brazil's next president. That's a big win, obviously, for him if that happens. Now, comparisons are already being made to the icons who are described as anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist. They need no description, really. I'm sure these figures are familiar to you. The late Fidel Castro, the late Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro of Cuba, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, and of course, you have at the end there, the Bolivian former president, Evo Morales. Now, why are people in Latin America actually voting for candidates to the left instead of a conservative government or ones to the right? Well, in short, raging poverty is one of the reasons, which is fanned by the COVID-19 pandemic now, which has actually pushed people to the left or to choose candidates that are from the left. People want a leader that not only promises economic prosperity, but this is important. They want an economic overhaul. I mean, they want the system changed. They are favoring economic overhaul over the bigger government and higher social spending, which has not given them economic prosperity. At the same time, people are rising up to reclaim their democracies and also to reclaim their constitution. Well, in the case of Chile, one is actually being written. Okay, rejoining us in this section is Dennis Small, Latin American editor at Executive Intelligence Review. Dennis, welcome back. We're looking at left-wing forces that are gaining ground in Latin America, the focus of this section over here. You're having elections being won by what's called the leftist candidates who are now presidents from Honduras to Peru, for example. Now, Brazil is supposed to be the next big one. Why has this occurred? Is that a sign of defeat for the Western economic model, do you think?
Yes, it is definitely a sign of defeat for the Western economic model. The question remains is, will there be a viable positive alternative in place to replace it? The simple defeat of an existing system and its institutions does not necessarily mean that the future will be bright. We could also descend into an era of extreme chaos, wars, and collapse of different forms. But there's no question but that the existing institutions, the parties, and other political forms across Ibero-America have been vastly discredited under the conditions of the crisis. And that has everything to do with the fact that the system in the transatlantic sector is in fact coming down. The neoliberal economic model has failed tremendously, and it's just getting worse under the conditions of the pandemic that's now underway.
Let's bring in Carlos Gonzalez, who joins us, the senior lecturer at London SoftBank University, to see what he thinks. Carlos Gonzalez, we just heard our guest there, Dennis Small. We're talking about the left-wing forces that are regaining control in Latin America. Do you agree that that's indeed happening? Is that a sign of defeat for the Western economic model, do you think?
I don't think neither at the moment. Neither of the two suggestions, the end or sign of defeat or triumph of Western economic model. We have to remember that the economic model that we got in Chile is called neoliberalism, which comes directly from Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom, put together in Chile by the Chicago Boys, which took the economic part of the government of the dictatorship, Pinochet dictatorship, and they imposed the trinity of free market trinity, what we call privatization, regulation, and cutting social spending.
He faces many challenges ahead. The split Congress, meaning no majority there, the sharp economic slowdown, although it could be short-term, and the writing of a new constitution. A split Congress is going to be a tricky one to handle. He will need to negotiate and make deals and alliances. And this could weaken his appeal among backers with high expectations of rapid change. For one of the most unequal countries in the world, Boric made some promises which were part of his appeal towards a win. He said we cannot continue to allow the poor to pay for the inequalities of Chile, adding we will reach out and build bridges so our citizens can live a better life.
When it comes to Chile, one thing stands out about this country in particular.